This week on the show, Adam Kaufman of WBZ AM Talk Celtics, Matt McCarthy of 98.5 The Sports Hub with the latest Giancarlo rumors, and we preview your Thanksgiving dinner. All that and more coming up. Calling It starts right now. Hello, everybody, and a happy Thanksgiving to you. Upcoming, this is our last show before Thanksgiving, Lovewitz.
Yeah, it's a huge day, for sure. Huge week.
We'll get more into Thanksgiving later in the show. We'll talk a little dinner plans, I guess you could call it. This is the Calling It podcast with Alex Barth and Alex Lovewitz, powered by CLNS Media. We thank you for joining us and tuning in on this. It is a triple Victory Monday. For those of you new to the show, we like to start off every show with a Victory Monday segment. We take a look around Boston sports, really around the world of sports, and see who deserves a Victory Monday recognition. And we have three Boston teams with a Victory Monday here this week. Obviously, the Patriots with the win on Sunday, the big win over the Raiders down in Mexico. We all know what's going on with the Celtics, and the Bruins managed to squeeze their way in, too, after losing Brad Marchand. They've won a couple of games. We'll get to the Bruins in a little bit, but let's start with the Patriots. We'll start with the most recent game first. They go down to Mexico City. What was it, 33-8, right, was the final? Yep. They steamrolled the Oakland Raiders, and my thought walking away from that game was, everybody, I think universally, had that game circled as the toughest game on the Patriots' schedule. You're going up against a good Raiders team, at least a team that a year ago was very good. You have to go to Mexico City. It's the second of back-to-back West Coast games. People had that tabbed as a scheduled loss for the Patriots, and that game was over at halftime. The concerns from earlier this year, you saw the Chiefs and the Giants, and I talked about this a little last night on our NFL recap, which you can go back and find on our YouTube page. You look at what the Chiefs have become. In that game yesterday, you see how far this Patriots team has come. And I think not all of those issues, but most of those issues in the beginning of the season have been put to bed. The Patriots have done exactly what I've been saying they will do. October becomes November, and they are curb stomping the rest of the NFL.
Yeah, you've seen it with a bunch of teams. They've gotten worse. They've taken a step back, whether it's throughout the year, in the case of the Chiefs, or just coming into the season a lot worse with the Raiders and the Broncos. The Patriots are not doing that. They're doing quite the opposite. They are playing more confidently than we've seen this season. Their offensive line is more sound than we have seen this season. Their defense is holding teams to under, you know, a couple scores routinely. This team is primed and ready to go for the playoffs, and it's exactly what you expect from a Patriots team, especially within the last 3-4 years. It seems like once we get into late November, December, they start to show signs of, yeah, they're the clear-cut favorite, and that's what we're seeing right now.
And the Raiders are not a bad team. I know they're under 500, but that offense still has a lot of firepower. Cordarrelle Patterson, I think, is an underrated player. Obviously, Crabtree and Tumor. Carr is a good quarterback. Jalen Richard had a great game running the ball yesterday. People shouldn't be sleeping on the Raiders because the Patriots beat a good team. You know, Denver, you want to say, okay, they have trouble with Denver, but it was a bad version of a Denver Broncos team. Sure. That Raiders team's decent. They have underperformed this year given the talent they have.
Yeah, I think that goes back to coaching. They just seem so undisciplined. I don't know.
It's a Jack Del Rio team.
It is. And I was texting with my friend who's a Raiders fan. And he fails to acknowledge that Jack Del Rio is not a very good coach. It's like, you watch them play, there are countless penalties, countless third and longs that their defense would just give up. They just were so outclassed by the Patriots. And it wasn't a talent thing. It was a coaching thing. They're just, again, it goes back to that main point. They've gotten worse, and so has a lot of the NFL, and the Patriots have gotten better despite a number of injuries. So, yeah.
I didn't mean to cut you off, but talk about the injuries, and that led me into my next point. I just want to kind of clarify this for people before you continue. We're used to the inactives coming out and it not being a huge deal. Maybe there's one or two players on that list that we usually factor in, but for the most part, they're players you know are going to be inactive going in. Let me read off yesterday's Patriots inactives to you, and you tell me if this was a player who was expected to make an impact at the beginning of the season. Chris Hogan.
Yes.
Marcus Cannon.
Yes.
David Andrews.
Yes.
Matthew Slater.
Yeah.
Eric Rowe.
Yes.
Malcolm Brown.
Yep.
Mike Gillisley.
Yeah.
Those are seven impact players the Patriots were missing. Trevor Riley played yesterday. Jonathan Jones played yesterday.
We had a good game, yeah. Jonathan Jones
had a great game, absolutely. Yeah. But these guys you thought would be scheduled inactives going into the season, you know, I'm trying to think of more examples from this year's team. They really haven't been because of the injuries. But going back a couple years, the guys like DJ Foster, the guys like in past years, Cameron Fleming had been in that role that you know were going to be inactives. They all played. They were missing seven key contributors yesterday.
Yeah, and it goes back to coaching, next man up. Obviously, that's a cliche thing to say. But they also had talent, and they've been good at drafting. One thing that I'm starting to really have a lot of appreciation for as a Pats fan is how well they evaluate the offensive line, because it just seems like they just plug guys in, and it takes 2-3 years for them to get acclimated.
Ted Karras yesterday.
Ted Karras. Joe Tooney, is, according to Pro Football Focus, I think he's the top guard in the NFL. Who would have thought that coming into the season? So they've just overperformed at every single position. Dante Hightower goes out, probably their most valuable player, not named Tom Brady, and their defense plays better. It's wild. It's crazy how good this team gets, and I think a lot of it goes back to the preparation leading into the week, staying in Colorado when Oakland's below sea level. They stayed there.
And remember, Jack Del Rio was borderline laughing at the Patriots for doing that.
And guess what? The Patriots ran no huddle pretty much the entire first half, and the Oakland Raiders' lack of conditioning showed.
Oh, they were gassed on that first drive. You could tell right away, and the Patriots did that on purpose. They knew.
Oh, yeah. It was a design game plan going in. They did not run the ball all that often, and they just wore out the Raiders and a lot of big plays on top of it. It wasn't even just wearing them out, you know, 10-yard play, 7-yard play, 5-yard play. It was Brandon Cooks, a couple 40-plus yard passes, Rob Gronkowski manhandling defenders, and Brady hitting a number of targets again that Oakland defense could not account for. They have a weak defense regardless.
Oh, they do, especially their secondary is slow.
Oh, yeah, especially when you compare him to guys like Brandon Cooks. So, you know, the Patriots, I had them winning this game easily. No surprise to me. The Raiders are just not the team that they were last season. A lot of that goes back to Derek Carr. I think a lot of it goes back to the fact that Del Rio is an overrated coach. So, yeah.
And I just want to touch on one more thing before we move on. You mentioned Brandon Cooks. I said on the pregame show yesterday the Patriots would have some chances to take shots. They did.
Yep.
250-plus yarders.
I think
they were both over 50. They were two big gainers to Brandon Cooks. And two parts here. One, Tom Brady, I don't want to say he's taking the back seat in the last two games against the Broncos and the Chargers, but he didn't have to come out and win them the game like he did early in the year against the Texans, for example.
Yeah.
I was happy to see him reassert himself. I just thought for a tendency point of view, for an opponent scouting point of view, they needed a big Brady game. So people couldn't start before teams started jumping all these short passes. And I think it's good Brady went out and had himself what will probably be one of his best games of the year. If it's not, he is going to have an incredible second half. And the other thing, I had somebody ask me on the CLNS media pregame show if Brandon Cooks was a disappointment.
No.
And this crowd still kind of exists. And yeah, they can all go lick the underside of a boat. I'm trying to make that a thing.
Okay.
Brandon Cooks, a top five receiver in the NFL. People criticize me for saying that. He's five, but he is top five. Brandon Cooks is a stud. I've said it time and time again. New Orleans got rid of the wrong guy. They should have traded Mike Thomas. They didn't. Brandon Cooks, look, he was not going to be Randy Moss. Nobody's Randy Moss, but he is the best receiver the Patriots have had since. People need to understand what a special talent this guy is. It's infuriating that people are still saying he's been a disappointment, and he's been the reason for the offensive struggles at times. It's killing me.
Oh, I agree. He's going to finish with 1,200 yards and probably 6 or 7 touchdowns. It's a great year for him.
He's fourth in the league in receiving.
Yeah, people were expecting Randy Moss. He's not that, but they have more targets than they did back then.
All right, we move on from the Patriots. The Boston Bruins, they lost Brad Marchand midweek. He went to the IR. I was an idiot. I sent out a tweet saying the season was cooked. They have 5 of their next 6 games against teams that are well above 500. They came out, they lost to the Ducks Wednesday night when they lost Marchand, but they beat the Kings and the Sharks back-to-back, two good teams, behind Anton Khudobin, the backup goaltender, and even Jimmy Murphy, who we had on the show last week, who is as staunch of a Tuca supporter as you will get, tweeted this week that it's time to move on to Doby. And we're going to learn a lot about the Bruins here coming up. They got the Devils, who are 11-5-3, the Penguins, the reigning Stanley Cup champions, the Oilers, who are under 500, but Connor McDavid, that's all you need to say, and then the Lightning, who are one of the best teams in the Eastern Conference. If they can go that next 4-game stretch, 3 of which are at home, if they can get 5 points in those 4 games, it completely turns things around. I think Khudobin should be the primary goaltender.
I agree with that. I don't know what the ceiling for this team is at the end of the day. And we've talked about the contrast in age on this team. You got a lot of really good young guys. You got some decent veterans. I don't know. I think the Bruins should be in sell mode. I think that this is a team that has some pieces with value that aren't going to be contributors to a Stanley Cup caliber team that you could probably trade for more assets and continue to build this team back up. Again, Heinen got a goal the other night. DeBrusque, it's all the young guys contributing. McAvoy, you know.
He had a great couple games.
And you know, they have injuries with Brad Marchand. That's the one guy that you could probably stand to keep, 29 years old. But Bergeron, Krejci, I don't know how much value Krejci has. Chara, get what you can. Even Rask. I just don't know what this team's really playing for because they're clearly not a top team in the NHL. And they got a boatload of young talent.
Let me see what happens with these next four games. If they can come out and they can be competitive against the likes of the Tampa Bay Lightning, I'm going to say maybe not necessarily buy, but you know, if you can get into the playoffs,
yeah,
if
it's the NHL.
If they're going to be seventh, and I'm going to steal Mike Felger's line here, and I'm sorry for that, but he's right. If you're going to be ninth in the conference, you might as well be eight and go for the playoffs.
Yeah.
If you're going to be 14th in the conference, you might as well be 15th and get the high pick. I think this next week will tell us if they're closer to that 8-9 range or that 14-15 range, and you go from there. They're actually going to be tested. Let's see how they handle the test. Obviously, there's one team that should be included in Victory Monday we haven't gotten to yet. We will do that on the other side here. Adam Kaufman of WBZ AM in Boston talks about the Celtics winning streak and how long they can keep it going. You're listening to Callin' It, powered by CLNS.
Callin' It is brought to you by American Broadcast Coaches, training the next generation of media talent and communicators. For more information, check out AmericanBroadcastCoaches.com.
Welcome back to Callin' It, continuing our Victory Monday segment. Obviously, we talked about the Patriots and the Bruins. We didn't get into the Celtics. We wanted to save that for Adam Kaufman of WBZ AM Radio in Boston. Adam, hello. Thanks for joining the show.
What's up, guys?
What's going on? Your first chance, right, to talk about the Celtics since Celtics at 7. I just want to start off by saying, as somebody who works Saturday mornings, I really enjoyed listening to that show, and I'm losing a part of my Saturday morning routine, and I'm going to miss your Celtics takes.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate that. Don't worry. The takes will still be there on Twitter or wherever else they come. But yeah, I'll miss the show as well. We had a good run there for a while.
You'll always have a spot to talk Celtics with us anytime you feel like you need to get something out. Let us know. We're more than happy to have
thank
you on.
You.
And let's start right here. The Celtics with a couple of big wins last week. Obviously, the Warriors game on Thursday and then against the Hawks on Saturday. Two come-from-behind wins. Why does it seem like, as good as this team has been, they're always trailing in the fourth quarter?
You know, it's hard to say. I think it probably boils down to the fact that they're not a very good shooting team. I mean, they've got, you know, all the heart and resiliency and that sort of cardiac kid, comeback kid mentality, all that stuff that you could possibly ask for of any team. They're as hardworking a club as you'll find in the NBA, and they are certainly and surprisingly unified and on the same page for a group that is generally all new. I mean, only four returning players from last year, and then everything that they worked on in training camp and preseason, much of it blew up 5:15 into the season when Gordon Hayward went down. So, you know, I think I'm one of most that is surprised by what they're doing in a lot of different ways. But as far as those late deficits are falling behind, I think it comes from the fact that as good as the defense has been and rebounding in some of the areas that some people were concerned about, the shooting has not been good. You know, they're a bottom 10 shooting team, whether from the field or from three in the entire league. And so when you know, when it's iron unkind for a while, you're going to fall into holes when the other teams get hot, if you're not defending at the rate that you want to, or even if you are and you go into shooting slumps. And I think they've seen a lot of that. But fortunately, this team has shown that virtually no deficit is too big. And, you know, I've just adopted the rule with this team that, you know, maybe you'd see a team down 15, 20 points in the first quarter or first half, and you'd say, well, it's not their night. If this team is trailing by, I'm not gonna worry at all unless this team is trailing by, say, 10, 12 points entering the fourth quarter. If it's a single-digit game, even 9, I'm confident they're going to be able to come back.
And one of those contributing factors to the shooting woes has been Marcus Smart. But despite that, his plus-minus has been through the roof. He's been a huge contributor on this team. One, how do you explain this kind of phenomenon? And two, do you expect them to rely on him less on the offensive end moving forward?
Well, so that's been one of the great questions, right? I mean, Marcus Smart is absolutely an enigma, and you watch him and you look at the box score after games and it's like, okay, he played 31 minutes and he went 1 for 8 from the field and he was still a plus 13. How in the hell is that possible? he's so good defensively and has such good instinct, such a high basketball IQ to find himself in the right place, whether it's for a key offensive rebound, a block, a steal. Maybe the 1-3 that he hits all night is a big one with 3 minutes to go in the fourth quarter. You know, whatever it is, he has a knack for the timely play, and that's why he is always out there on the floor in crunch time and in the closing minutes, much of the fourth quarter and all of that. Brad Stevens implicitly trusts him. And on top of that, we may bitch and moan about the shooting and the fact that he's shooting like 26-28%, whatever the hell it is. It hasn't been good, not nearly as good as I thought he would be this year. I thought he'd take a step forward, maybe eventually he will, but so far, pushing a quarter of the way through the year, that hasn't been the case. Stevens wants him to keep shooting. You know, it's that whole shooter's got to shoot mentality, and you can say, well, he's not much of a shooter, and you wouldn't be wrong, but Stevens sees things differently. He wants him to continue to shoot. He wants all of his guys to continue to shoot. If you have a good opening there, you know, take advantage of it. You know, you're wide open. Don't force the pass if you feel like you're in the right spot. You're in the corner, you're straight away, whatever it may be. Where I get frustrated sometimes with Marcus Smart is when the infrequent times when he makes a poor basketball decision. You know, there are some knucklehead plays out of him, and they're few and far between, granted, but there are some. I mean, you saw it even late in that game against the Warriors. You know, he had some terrible moments in that game and in that fourth quarter especially, and still was like plus 15. So I think he's incredibly valuable to this team. And if nothing else, who knows? Maybe it'll work out to their advantage. The fact that he's shooting so poorly, it'll cost them less in restricted free agency.
Yeah, seems like a guy who's cost himself a lot of money. Looking down the road here for the Celtics, I think we're also locked in on the Warriors game. We didn't bother to check what was next. They took care of a bad Hawks team on Saturday. Hypothetically, the Celtics would go for their 20th straight win Thursday, November 30th at home against the Sixers. To do so, they have to get through Dallas, Miami, and then a back-to-back home and road against the Magic and the Pacers and then the Pistons. Obviously, on the road, second night of a back-to-back is tough. Any games there, Adam, that particularly stand out to you as, okay, this could be the night that it all falls apart?
No, not really. I mean, seriously, that's not homerism. It's just that, you know, the teams that you're really worried about so far along the way, Thunder, Spurs, obviously the Warriors, the Bucks, you know, there have been challenges, and they just keep it's one checklist after another. You know, they just keep checking boxes left and right. And so I'm not going to say they're going to win all of those games, because letdowns do happen, especially with back-to-backs or travel or whatever else. You know, there are just going to be nights where, hey, it's not clicking and you're not – there's only so often you're able to fall down by 15, 17, 18 points and come all the way back, as they've made a habit of doing. So if they should happen to lose one of these upcoming games, I'm not going to be floored. I mean, the Pistons, they're a good team. I don't think they're as good as their record indicates, but they're a good team. The Magic, same story. But for the most part, you're looking at teams that are either under 500, in the case of the Mavs, way under 500, 3-14 going into that game, and some other teams that are mediocre to bad. You know, I mean, they're 500 teams, basically, and the Pistons being a little bit better than that. So I'm not going to sit here and say, you know, watch out, Lakers or Warriors or whoever else. You know, the Celtics are about to go on a 30-game winning streak, but could they reach 20 sitting here on 15 right now with a schedule of sort of less than imposing threats in front of them? Yeah, they absolutely could, and that would be so insane to me. It would be I'm overstating. This is hyperbole, but I don't care. It would be top five in the history of Celtics. The history of the Celtics organization, it would be top five in the list of things that are just so wildly unpredictable and improbable. For this group, without Gordon Hayward, to be put together, you know, brand new in the offseason, to start 0-2 and then reel off a 20-game winning streak, which would set a new franchise record for consecutive wins, that would be unbelievable to me. And yet, we're not far away.
And we're talking to Adam Kaufman of WBZ News Radio, and you mentioned the absence of Hayward, and part of the reason why they've excelled so much this year is because you have two guys, young kids, and Jason Tatum and Jaylen Brown, who have stepped up and filled in that void. So my question is, what's impressed you more, Jason Tatum's start to his NBA career or Jaylen Brown's progress from last year to this year?
It would have to be Tatum. It'd be close. I mean, Jaylen Brown has been very impressive, but I think you saw, even going back to summer league and preseason, that if he had the opportunity, if he had the minutes, if he had the role, this was a possibility. You know, I thought coming into the year, and I wrote about it, talked about it a lot on my show at the time, you know, for me, with this team being healthy, so that's with Hayward and without all those injuries they've already suffered through the first 17 games, I figured Jaylen Brown was going to give them 15 points a game. That was the kind of guy he should have been. And then when Hayward went down, I said, wait a minute. I mean, he should give you like 18 points a game. And I don't even know what the average is right now, but it's, you know, probably right in that neighborhood. But Jason Tatum, you know, nobody saw him starting every game of his pro career to this point, or giving you 30-plus minutes a game, or being as consistent as he has been. And you could argue he's been as consistent as anybody on that roster. And he's shooting so well, damn near 50% from three and from the field, giving you a consistent 14, 15 points, hauling down, what, 7, 8 rebounds. I mean, his production for a teenager, a 19-year-old kid, it has been remarkable. You know, nobody would have seen that coming. You know, I thought he'd give you maybe 20 minutes a game. And again, these were projections when everybody was healthy. But, you know, 20 points or rather 20 minutes, 10 points, you know, for him to be doing what he's doing, it's wild. You know, I wouldn't have put him anywhere near the Rookie of the Year conversation. And he still won't win because there's Ben Simmons. But for him to even be, you know, in the top three, which is where he would be right now, is pretty unbelievable.
Anytime you need some green Kool-Aid injected into your veins, you can find Adam Kaufman on Twitter, at Adam M. Kaufman. Adam, thanks for coming on, and hopefully we're talking about this winning streak again later on in the season.
Hope so, guys.
Calling It is brought to you by American Broadcast Coaches, training the next generation of media talent and communicators. For more information, check out AmericanBroadcastCoaches.com.
Welcome back to Calling It. Alex Barth and Alex Lebowitz with you, powered by CLNS. 2 weeks away from the winter meetings now, Lebowitz, yep. And that means the rumors are starting to drop. We got a big-time one this morning. We have our first official reported sourced offer in the Giancarlo Stanton saga. Joining us to help break it down from 98.5 The Sports Hub is Matt McCarthy. Matt, how you doing?
Oh, it's like Christmas has come early for us baseball nerds. We got all these rumors going on. I am doing well, guys. Thanks for having me.
All the credit to you for being able to follow, what, five levels of minor league baseball for 30 teams. I can't keep track of all of them. All the power to you if you can. I don't know how you do it.
Baseball America is a wonderful, wonderful resource. I will say that.
So this is from Craig Mish of SiriusXM this morning on Twitter. Source, Giants Marlins names exchanged in potential Stanton deal. Joe Panik, Tyler Beede, and Chris Shaw on the Giants side. On the Marlins side, obviously Stanton and D. Gordon. So we'll start here before we get into the Red Sox angle, Matt. Is that a fair offer for Giancarlo Stanton? Panik, Beede, and Shaw.
Here's the part that interests me about this offer. It's the Gordon element. I certainly understand why the Marlins would be interested in Joe Panik. I think Panik is an excellent player, and I think we underappreciate how good of a player Panik is here on the East Coast, not seeing him all the time. And you're looking at two of the top three, arguably maybe the top two prospects in the Giants system in Shaw and Beede. So, you know, when it comes to the Giants system, which is not great, yeah, that's probably, you know, they're probably not going to do too much better when it comes to the San Francisco Giants and what they can offer. I'm just interested in the Gordon element. I wonder why Gordon is in that deal. You know, if they want to, you know, get rid of Gordon, I feel like they can maybe move him in a separate deal instead of this deal. But that's the element that really interests me when it comes to this reported offer this morning.
So given what we've seen out of this offer from the Giants, what do you think it would take for the Red Sox to acquire Giancarlo Stanton?
Well, if we're just going to compare the offers, you look at probably Xander Bogaerts. You know, Bogaerts and Panic, while they don't play the same position, are both middle infielders and both at the big league level. So you look at Bogaerts essentially being the equivalent to what the Giants are offering in Panic. Jason Groom is the Red Sox best pitching prospect. Beattie is the Giants' best pitching prospect, so that would be the equivalent player there. And then when it comes to Chris Shaw, the Red Sox would tell you that's probably a Michael Chavis. So you're looking at Bogaerts, Chavis, and Jason Groom for Giancarlo Stanton. I would do that in a heartbeat. Here's the problem, though. I don't think the Marlins would, because I think the Marlins would want Benintendi or Devers in place of Chavis. Their argument to the Red Sox is going to be, when the Red Sox, you know, let's say hypothetically come at them with that equivalent trade, their argument to the Red Sox would be, listen, you know, Shaw is the best prospect, the best hitting prospect that the Giants have. Chavis is not the best hitting prospect you have. That's either Benintendi, although, you know, granted he's not a prospect anymore, or Rafael Devers. So there's a chance that the Marlins come back and they want more from the Red Sox. There's also a pretty decent chance that the Marlins like Joe Panic better than Xander Bogaerts. I know we wouldn't have said that 2 years ago, but there's a chance that they evaluate Panic in a better position than Xander Bogaerts. So, you know, it remains to be seen, you know, what they end up doing with that. Can the Red Sox top the deal? Absolutely. My question is, will they be willing to top the deal? And, you know, if it comes down to trading a guy like Rafael Devers, are they willing to do that? I think that's the most important question that we have still yet to answer about the Red Sox and their pursuit of Stanton.
Well, do you think if Dombrowski was willing to move Devers or Benintendi, one, do you think he would have put it on the table already? And two, do you think we would know about it?
No, I don't think he would have put it on the table already, and I don't think we would know about it, because I think this is the beginning of the process. I think that this deal goes down at the winter meetings. You know, this type of stuff starts to kind of bubble to the surface, and the chatter starts to begin right after the GM meetings, which happened this past week. That's where these discussions start, and then they work towards the winter meetings, and that's oftentimes where these deals go down. So I think you're going to hear a lot of chatter and a lot of rumors over the next 2 weeks, and I think ultimately the Marlins pull the trigger on the best offer that they get by the winter meetings or sometime during the winter meetings.
Again, we're talking to Matt McCarthy of 98.5 The Sports Hub, and a little other baseball news today. The Hall of Fame ballot was, I guess you could say, released. You know who it's going to be because of the criteria, but we could have that age-old discussion about Bonds, about Clemens, about Sosa and that. But the new question that may be answered this year, and this is the age-old question for baseball fans, as borderline gets, Johnny Damon on the ballot for the first year, Matt McCarthy, is Johnny Damon a Hall of Famer? Not first ballot, ever.
Age-old question. Well, I'm not sure if I've ever heard that one brought up ever before, and I'm not sure if I ever will hear it ever again.
You ask if Damon's a Hall of Famer?
Not really, and I would say vehemently no. I do not think Johnny Damon is a Hall of Famer. He was a very nice player. He's a Hall of Very Good player. But was Johnny Damon one of the best players of his generation? And I have a hard time saying no, and I really doubt the baseball acumen of anybody who says that Johnny Damon was one of the best players of his generation. Not to disparage Johnny Damon, he was a very nice player, a glue guy, a spark plug, one of the better leadoff hitters in baseball for a time. But no, Johnny Damon is not a Hall of Famer. Not in my book. No way, no how.
For the first ballot, guys, there's two names at the top of the list that kind of stick out, Chipper Jones and Jim Thome. I want to ask you, is Jim Thome specifically a first ballot guy? He hit 612 home runs in his career.
You know, you would think that 612 home runs would get you in on the first ballot, and that should seem pretty automatic. Tomey's an interesting case, though, because I don't think anybody ever really thought that Jim Thome was one of the, you know, five best hitters in baseball or, you know, whatever over the course of his career. But man, I mean, all he did was just mash home runs for 20 years. You know, and, you know, no matter where he went, be it in Cleveland or Philly, wherever he went, he just hit home runs. American League, National League didn't matter. So he's a Hall of Famer. Yes. I'm fascinated to see what type of response and what type of vote he gets on the first ballot. I would think that 612 home runs gets you in on the first ballot, but you know what? Oftentimes, you know, some of these voters won't, you know, or at least will hold on for a while. You know, when it comes to, you know, power hitters in the steroid era, you look at a guy like Jeff Bagwell, who had to wait a while to get in. So I've stopped trying to predict, who will be a first ballot Hall of Famer when it comes to power hitters in this era. Vlad Guerrero's on the ballot this year. He nearly made it last year in his first ballot. I would say Vlad Guerrero was not a much better player, but was a, you know, you could pretty easily say that he was a better player than Jim Thome, and he was a power hitter, and he didn't make it in last year. Now, granted, Thome has more home runs, so it remains to be seen. I think Thome comes very close, maybe even gets in on the first ballot, but he will be in at some point. The question is he a first ballot guy or not? That's what I'm really fascinated by.
Matt McCarthy from 98.5 The Sports Hub. You can follow him on Twitter at MattMcCarthy98.5. On the other side here, we will do our Thanksgiving food power rankings. But Matt, before we let you go, I know you have an interesting take on this. We'll give you the soapbox here for 60 seconds.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a turkey is the worst thing of all time. Yeah. And it is the worst meal you could possibly ever imagine.
You're a lunatic.
To have.
You're a lunatic.
I thought I had my 60 seconds.
Go ahead. Sorry, go ahead.
Let me break it down for you. Thanksgiving is one of the great holidays. It might be the best holiday in the year. It's awesome. You're thankful for things, your family, your friends, all the little things in your life that, you know, makes it so great. And then we sit down and we celebrate with poultry. Poultry. I mean, bland as bland could be. Give me a break. I don't take the bird out of the oven, let the bird fly around. I don't care what happens to the turkey, so long as it's not on my Thanksgiving plate. It's bland. It tastes like nothing. You want to celebrate. You want to celebrate Thanksgiving. You want to be thankful for something. Put a nice lobster in front of me. Put a nice steak in front of me. Anything. Put anything else in front of me other than turkey. The only thing, only redeeming quality about turkey is you can stuff it with stuffing. And then you take the stuffing out and you eat the stuffing, and you might as well just kick the bird carcass right in the trash because it's useless. Useless. U-S-E-L-E-S-S. Useless. 100% worthless turkey. Get it out of my kitchen on Thanksgiving. I don't want to see it.
So is this an attack against all poultry? You said poultry. Do you not like chicken or duck? Do you hate every type of bird?
Let me tell you something about chicken. It's even worse than turkey.
Oh, my God.
Chicken is even more bland than turkey. I mean, you put it this way. To make chicken anywhere near good, you have to fry the living hell out of it. I mean, you know, why is Kentucky Fried Chicken so big? Because chicken stinks. And you have to fry the hell out of it to make it even anywhere near good. So, no, get all poultry out of my kitchen and away from me on Thanksgiving. I am thankful for none of it.
I have said some absurd things on this show, and I will stand by those, but that may have been the hottest take dropped on Calling It.
I think it is, yeah.
At Matt go ahead.
Put it this way, gentlemen. You know, 2 years ago on Thanksgiving, I was on with Sean McAdam, and I closed out the show with, you know, my thoughts on turkey, and I don't think Sean has spoken to me since.
It's a sensitive topic.
At Matt McCarthy, 98.5 on Twitter. Let him hear it. The turkey hater himself from 98.5. Thanks for coming on the show.
Always good, guys. Thanks a lot.
Calling It is brought to you by American Broadcast Coaches, training the next generation of media talent and communicators. For more information, check out AmericanBroadcastCoaches.com.
Welcome back to Calling It, our Thanksgiving edition. Before we go, we want to give everybody a little taste of Thanksgiving. We decided to come up, me and Lebowitz, with our top five Thanksgiving foods, Thanksgiving food power rankings. Now, here are the parameters. It's dinner only, so appetizers don't count. Just foods, no drinks, none of that.
Like hors d'oeuvres, you mean.
Right, hors d'oeuvres. Yeah, that's what I meant. Yeah, appetizers count. No hors d'oeuvres, no pigs in a blanket, whatever, nachos. We're all eating that during the day. Your top five Thanksgiving sit-down-to-dinner foods. Lebowitz, we'll start with you. Your top five.
Number one, Stuffing.
Let's go five. All right, you ruined it. I was going to say 5-1, but go.
Okay,
ahead.
I'll go 5-1. I'll go the other way. Number five, it's I got a two-way tie. Apple pie is one of them. The other one, if you're an American Jew, it's Thanksgiving's a warm-up to Hanukkah. Potato kugels up there for me. That's number five. Four, turkey. I'm not as against turkey as Matt McCarthy, but
well, that would be hard.
I understand the gripe. I do. Brisket's above turkey. That's my number three. Number two, mashed potatoes. Number one is stuffing.
All right, so I went a little more traditional. Number five, chocolate cake, specifically trifle cake, if you know what that is.
Okay,
my mom makes a great trifle cake. Number four, cornbread. I think it's very underrated, especially if you have some sort of chili or something to dip it in. Love myself some cornbread. That's going to help soak up whatever's in your stomach from during the day, too. Number three, I have stuffing at three. I have mashed potatoes at two, and that was really – I mean, you call them 2A and 2B.
Yeah.
I like the starches. And number one, Matt McCarthy can go lick the underside of a boat. Turkey with a whole lot of gravy on top of it. It is the best part of Thanksgiving. It is a major reason that Thanksgiving is, in fact, the best holiday, narrowly beating out the 4th of July. We can talk about that a little bit, but so stuffing versus mashed potatoes, I just feel like mashed potatoes – you can get like – you can get stuffing, like the microwave stuffing, easy, what's it called, stovetop.
Uh-huh.
And that's good. Microwave mashed potatoes aren't as good. Stuffing as a whole is probably better, but when you get like the homemade good mashed potatoes, those are better than stuffing. I don't know about you, in my house, we only get those once a year, and that's on Thanksgiving.
Mashed potatoes?
The homemade mashed potatoes.
Okay. Yeah.
I'll make like microwave mashed potatoes, but like the actual, you peel the potato, you mash in the
butter, cream.
Right, exactly.
All that
I only
jazz.
Get those like once a year. So that's why I have that over stuffing.
I would say stuffing's more of a seasonal thing. That's why I put it at number one, because you only like, you have mashed potatoes at other meals, at restaurants, what have you. Stuffing is solely for Thanksgiving, and it's delicious. I love stuffing. It's my favorite thing. And if you make stuffing the right way, it's awesome. Same thing with mashed potatoes. Stuffing's number one. That's the goat for me. I wish they served it at every meal.
And you had apple pie at number five, right?
Yeah.
We both went desserts at number five. Can I make the case here for cake over apple pie? It still has fruit in it, okay? It's Thanksgiving. I want to get fat. I want to snap a button off my pants. Give me good old high sugar chocolate cake, big heaping of Cool Whip on the top. I want to feel it.
Thanksgiving is an American holiday. It is America's holiday, along with the 4th of July, of course. Apple pie is the most American dish out there. If you don't have apple pie on your list ahead of chocolate cake, you should just move out.
Let me ask you this: with or without ice cream?
Either. Who cares?
If you add the ice cream to it, maybe I can, because then you get the sugar.
I mean, the apples are tossed in sugar. That's it. It's not
that's
just apples.
That's true. That's true. So. I know one of my family members is a pecan pie person. That's what we're going to have.
That's another one. Pumpkin pie.
You ever had Thanksgiving with a vegan?
They're not allowed in my house.
I'm doing that for the first time this year.
That sucks.
So we have all these dietary things. My brother has a gluten. He's not gluten-free because of a fad, which is the dumbest fad. That diet sucks.
Yeah.
Okay, anybody who does that by choice is a moron. I have to do that sometimes. My brother is celiac. He can't help it. So we have the gluten-free dietitians. My grandmother keeps kosher, so we have that.
There you go.
And now we're adding a vegan. So it's all over the place. I just see it as more turkey for me. It's Looney Tunes, though, how you could be vegan on Thanksgiving.
I feel like you have to at least break it one day a year. That's it. And at least this person isn't pushing their veganism on you. Like,
well, I don't know. We'll see. He might.
You don't need the soy turkey or anything like that.
I don't think there's a soy turkey.
That would end in murder if that was at my house.
I would not be pleased with a soy turkey. well, we're in the spirit of power rankings here real quick. So you keep talking about the 4th of July. I go Thanksgiving 1, 4th of July 1A.
Thanksgiving's a family holiday. 4th of July is a like going out with the boys
holiday. But Thanksgiving has football.
Thanksgiving – or 4th of July is summer.
But football.
But
that's my only comeback is football. I don't know. It could be nice on Thanksgiving. It was really nice last year, if I recall.
You go to a beach house or a lake, drink beers, just don't worry about anything and get inebriated beyond belief. There's nothing better than
that. I love the holiday season, but I will say New Year's is not a part of the holiday season.
It's overrated.
I like Christmas time, Hanukkah, whatever you celebrate around the end of December. I love the spirit of all that. Mm-hmm. New Year's is – I put New Year's below Arbor Day. I can't stand New Year's.
It's depressing. It's a depressing holiday.
You're forced to look at yourself and reflect and realize how little you accomplished in the last year. It's miserable. There's a reason people drink themselves into oblivion on New Year's.
And it signifies a new year, but more so it signifies you have two more months of horrible cold weather that you had to live through. It sucks.
It's brutal. Not just signifies a new year. It signifies another year gone that you don't have.
So, yeah.
On that depressing note, that will do it for this episode of Calling It. We'll be back next week. Same time, same place. Make sure you follow us on Twitter at Calling It Podcast. Download the CLNS Media app for your smartphone. You can subscribe on iTunes. I think that's all of it, right?
Yep.
So we hope you enjoyed the show. A happy Thanksgiving to you and your family, of course, from everybody here at Calling It. We will be back next week. So until then, he's Alex Lovitz. I'm Alex Barth. This has been Calling It, powered by CLNS.